You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Christy Rupp. Christy, thanks so much for being with me today.
Oh, fun to be here.
So, Christy, let's talk about recent work. I know you just put two shows up, and you have one that you're about to put up in a week. Can you go through those shows and tell me a little bit about it, I guess, starting with the two that just went up?
Sure. In early January, I did an installation at the Wild Bird Fund in New York of work that I had finished late in the fall. It was shown in a traditional gallery, but right now it's at the Wild Bird Fund, which is an animal rehab. It's New York's only bird rehab center for wild things. And they have an empty storefront that artists hang work in that rotates. So it's all up there in this wonderful context of public art and things that are alive in the city, and the general kind of emergency room nature of the place, where people are bringing in injured hawks and owls and swans and lots of pigeons. So I had made this work about birds over the last year and a half from those net bags that you buy, that you get in the grocery store, that your garlic comes in or potatoes come in. Can you picture those plastic?
Yeah, I can. They're sort of mesh bags. They have some kind of mesh in them, right?
Yes. And also Christmas trees come in them. You know, a wider mesh. And these things are terribly hazardous to wildlife. And they always end up, when they're thrown out, the wind picks them up, so they end up in the ocean. And, you know, they can easily swim in the ocean for hundreds of years. So they package things for about, you know, 10 minutes for produce that has a very quick shelf life. But the packaging itself is discarded. And I started, well, first I was cutting them up in all the ways I could think of that would render them harmless. And I was spending so much time doing it that at some point a couple of years back I said, well, I'm going to just start saving these. And then gradually, as I accumulated many of them, I grew to really respect their structure and their color and just the way they enhance the product. And so I thought, what to do with these? Well, maybe I can make birds with them. And then it took me on this exploration of birds in art history. And I've never done appropriation before. But as I looked at paintings, mostly paintings, historically of birds, they're either dead, they're fighting, they're defending their nest, or they're being bullied by a human, such as one of my favorites, Miró's painting, woman throwing a stone at a bird, or another one, the kind of seminal one that we think of is the goldfinch, which, if you remember the painting, has a very small bird chained to a perch in a Dutch pub.
Right.
Another famous one is the threatened swan. That's a famous one from the Rijks Museum. And so I was like, wow, this is really interesting that's the way we form our attitude about birds and, by extension, nature. And so I set about recreating a lot of those paintings in this plastic net bag material. I'm a welder, so I usually make things in metal rod. And so I kind of draw things in space, and then in this case, that was kind of an armature for just plastic netting.
That's powerful and gives an introduction into you know, the way you're working as an artist. And that show is currently up now, is that correct?
Yes, it's called Snags, and it's up through, I think, the month of February. And it's
And where is it exactly? I mean, we'll put links within the article, but...
It's like Columbus, I think, and 86th Street on the east side.
Okay.
The most amazing place about this wild bird fund is just, it's not the exotic bird, which everybody hopes, you know, will be like the photo moment that will get the place, you know, in the New York Times, which does happen a lot. But it's an amazing kind of act of compassion that they save all these pigeons. And they have these little isolation wards for pigeons, the ones that are sick. And a lot of them are getting IV fluids. A lot of them are taped up. But then there's also a lot of birds that are just kind of running around the place. So it makes working there really fun. And I want to give them another proposal next year for turtles, because they do have.
So tell me, you gave them a proposal. How did that work? Was that, did they have an open call, or you went there and just gave a proposal because you know the place?
My friend is a bird maniac, and he has been photographing pigeons for a long time. Andrew Garn has a book coming out about pigeons, and he just made himself their photographer, I don't know, a year or two ago, and developed the space. And he was advocating for me to do this, and I kept saying I'd love to do it when I get this body of work done. But actually, I have so much work that fits into that context. It's really not a problem. But the reason that I really love it is that it does kind of take down the boundaries between people and animals in the city. And so it was a natural for me.
And
but
what
yeah,
was,
they're always
there's
looking for proposals. Pardon?
You're saying, so go on. They're always looking for proposals?
Yes. They have no shortage of animal artists that love to come see the work and show their work there. But it's always, you know, anyone can pretty much take advantage of this really fun thing. So the other show that just opened on Friday is at David and Schweitzer in Brooklyn, and it's about climate change. It was five women sculptors, the kind that actually make things with our hands. And the original idea was everybody's working in different veins. Ruth Hardinger is interested in fugitive emissions from gases underground, like methane. Becca Smith is interested in atmosphere. And Babs Rheingold is interested in deforestation. And then another artist at the gallery found Keelan Perry from Atlanta. I think she had collected ocean debris. And I was included because of really what I'm interested in, which is biodiversity loss and migration. So I have work in there that's a life-size manatee made out of gold credit cards and a bunch of frogs that are made out of green credit cards, because I kind of locked into this idea about endangered or threatened species and the credit crisis, because... Mm-hmm. For a while, I started saving these things long ago before I had an idea. Remember, like maybe, well, before 08, before the crash of 08, we would get all these credit cards in the mail, solicitations to sign up and start, you know, using our balance. And I just thought, actually, this is crazy that they're trying to get us into debt so hard. And also, these credit cards are really beautiful. I can't believe all the design work that goes into them. And so I started saving them. And then over time, it made sense to me that the debt crisis has a lot to do with extinct animals, because in order to classify as extinct, an animal can't have been sighted in the wild for 50 years. So we really have no idea what's extinct. You know, it's, we're talking a 50-year horizon. And it's a lot like that with debt and with credit, that it's completely kind of manipulated. And I had thought a lot about, like, the Latin American debt, or now in the news is the Puerto Rican debt, and how everybody's going, well, just write it off. You know, they can make it go away. And I thought, yeah, that's true. With man-made credit, you can do that. But in natural systems, they're so much easier to destroy than they are to repair. Actually, you can't repair them. But yet, we're both in both cases, we're borrowing from the future. So anyway, I started making all these threatened species out of credit cards, like a silver walrus, gold manatee, a blue and a green seal, and a bunch of frogs. Like that.
And that's what's in that show as well.
That's what's in the Planet A show in Brooklyn.
And have you shown in that gallery before?
I had worked with Keith Schweitzer at the Lodge. If you remember the Lodge on Christie Street, they've just closed the doors on it. It went for 5 years.
Right.
It was a really lovely space. They did some very imaginative shows. And I actually was in the first show there when they did a Cabinet of Curiosities. I've been in a lot of shows that are kind of art and science related. That's what that show was.
And the third show, so there's one more coming up.
That one is a big group show, which I don't know much about. It's called Brand New Art and Commodities in the 80s. And it's at the Hirshhorn. It opens next week. And they claim to have put a new spin on consumer culture from the 80s. So I have to go see it, right? Figure it out.
Right.
Art and commodity in the 80s. So I don't know. I don't know how you reinvent that, but tell us, you know.
Right. Yeah, that should be interesting. So, you know, you said also, I mean, just to step back a little bit, You've had shows where the sciences and arts were somehow a part of that your work's always been linked to that.
Yeah.
That's what you were just saying? Yeah. When did that first happen, do you think? Or what was a project that or work that made that consistently so for you? Was there a turning point in that?
From the very beginning, I think even in high school, I've been really interested in studying animal behavior. And as I was in college and would come to New York in the 70s and look at shows that were conceptual artists, famous conceptual artists in those giant Soho spaces, it occurred to me that the work was so often presented like science. And I thought, wow, animal behavior is like art. You know, science is like art. I could really see the connection with conceptual art. Mostly because it kind of made everyday things, it elevated that to information. And I just started on this whole science and nature thing, and just observing animal behavior, which of course extends to human behavior, but it's so much easier to watch like a rat in the alley, you know, making a plan for it, like pizza rat, you know. It's so much easier to watch that than people. Well, it's fun to watch people, but it's animal behavior is not entertainment for most people. But I can just watch birds all day. Or I just came back from my annual manatee pilgrimage to North Florida to watch these giant creatures kind of lolling around in the shallows, and occasionally they move a little.
Right.
But I got interested in more than animals. The work is really about habitat and economics and changing habitat. And
well, that's also an aspect of it that's activist, right? I mean, there's the research portion, but also we're talking about social justice yes. as well as part
They're
of the
one
content,
in the same.
Right?
Economic justice and ecological justice are the same thing, and social justice. So I got really curious about how we frame nature, like how do we create our impressions of nature, and how is that used to create a desired outcome. And like most baby boomers in post-war America, my childhood impressions of nature were framed by Walt Disney, who was making lots of, he was really the first one to make entertaining nature films. And Hollywood was cultivating the emerging market for children's entertainment. They were just identifying us as a demographic. And so a really formative film for many of us was Bambi. And he laid out the context of the Bambi syndrome, which was kind of, although Bambi was wild and he was the prince of the forest, he had human characteristics, like his diverse little group of woodland friends. And they had emotions, human emotions, and they were either, you know, like Thumper was very curious, and the skunk, who I can't remember what his name was, smelled bad. And the subtext of Bambi was that man and nature, man and deer, can never exist. You know, man is always the in Bambi, Bambi was the prince of the forest. He wasn't a cog in the ecology of the forest. He was the leader. Even though deer all have the same parents, the same father. That's what the antlers are about. They're all actually half brothers. But anyway, in the movie, he's the prince of the forest. And it struck me that that the Hudson River School of Painters were also framing nature within the context of mysticism for their own needs too, their own ends, which in their case was to further an American School of Painting. It was the first ecological American School of Painting. So I've always been interested in noticing the way nature is presented to us. And that's really where my work lives. And so it's really about...
that pulls from, as you were saying, the science, how things are presented, how animal behavior is presented, the way things are presented. That's the conceptual kind of angle there. How it's presented to us as in Bambi, but also in other things that you're discussing.
Right. Well, Bambi's the one that everybody remembers really well. It doesn't just have to be the nature films. Like any of his films, like Lady and the Tramp, had all kinds of concepts of nature and breeding and architecture that are really icons for us growing up and all over the world too.
Right. It's exciting to look at it all that way, because of course we all have those filters, is what I was going to say, you know, of how we're kind of taught, or you know, and from all the books we've read too, or were read, you know, that were read to us about how it's all presented. And and so you're going to continue in this work. I know you're, it's not that you're playing another project now, you're mounting this show that's coming up next, correct?
Well, the show in at the Hirshhorn is a group show, so I don't have to. And it's from the 80s. No, right now I'm doing research to get going on a body of work about migration and a loss of diversity, and just really thinking a lot about how migration has changed, how normally when we learn about or think about migration, we think of it in terms of cyclical seasonal shifts, but how migration now has become fragmented, and we have all these species that are moving into regions that are novel, and how we have all these exotic species that populate everywhere now, and how, you know, that's going to make it exponentially harder to take care of diversity. Because even in a situation like with the hurricanes or the Gulf oil spill, when you have a loss of habitat, it doesn't matter. Like a whale or a dolphin can swim out of an oil spill, but if their feeding ground is damaged, they can't breed. They can't thrive. You know, breeding is all about thriving. It's not about surviving. So in Puerto Rico, if the shoreline is wiped out or if the forests are wiped out, sure, you might have the birds, but their food source is gone.
Right.
So I'm really interested in how that parallels human migration, and also how we're all climate refugees of one sort or another. You know, even if we have to turn on the air conditioner in winter or go to the store and buy water, you know, it's something that we're all a part of right now.
It's so true. And, Christy, before we go, I wanted to ask you what you're reading at the moment. Could be off-topic or not.
Well, right now I'm reading climate fiction. It's a whole bunch of, it's a genre. It's called cli-fi. It was coined by the Indian writer Amitav Ghosh. And I'm reading a book called Gold Fame Citrus, which is about the desertification of California when it turns into a desert. And the movie stars have to abandon their homes. And anybody who's still left gets rounded up and taken to Pennsylvania, resettled. Mm. But I just finished a book called New York 2140, where it was about the flooding of New York. It, you know, it happens 100 years into the future. And downtown was in much worse shape than uptown. I guess it is lower. But people still want to live there because it's where all the cool people live. And there's this thing called wet equity, which is sort of a parallel of sweat equity. And it's just it's a very funny book about lots of ferry boats and skywalks. And, you know, it's basically the cleverness of technology making up for this amazing handicap of not being able to walk on the sidewalk.
Right.
And these books kind of break down in the ones I've only read about five or six into the ones that we go into some kind of tribal culture where everybody's looking out for themselves, or the ones where technology solves it for us. Mm. And it's just it's interesting because this is the same, like, how are we framing nature? And we're framing it by denying it, basically. Like, we have no idea how to really process climate change because we're working off of models. Like, nobody really knows how much heat we've put into the atmosphere, and things like methane release as the Arctic melts, you know, all these plants that have been frozen, they start to rot, and it releases all this CO2. So we have no idea these cycles that have been released, where how they'll work together. Mm. And all we have is sort of our denial, like, oh, I can not have to mow my lawn, or, you know, we just think about consuming our way out of it.
Right. Well, I'm glad you share those books with us as well. I want to thank you for talking to me today. It's been a pleasure talking about your work, and I hope the listeners will investigate your website and find their way to your shows.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.